given that Alastair had not spoken to the woman in over a year. Her words could have been misinterpreted by others as insulting and dismissive. But those others would have been unaware of the pair's familial relationship, a relationship which they endeavored to hide from prying eyes.
"Aunt Kate, I need the Salamanca," said Alastair.
If the older woman was taken aback by Alastair's abrupt demand for her ship, the only sign was the slight hardening of her eyes.
"Is it that bad?"
Alastair gave a shrug of his shoulders. His reluctance to give a direct answer was enough for Kate to switch personas from distant, convivial aunt to the captain of a merchant ship that she was.
"How many do I need to lift?"
"A company plus, along with their Caspers and ancillary equipment," said Alastair.
In the trivy, Kate closed her eyes for a second as she did the mental math.
"I'd need to dump most of our current cargo to make room, and top off the F-11 tanks."
"The Scorpions will cover the costs," interjected Alastair.
Kate gave a short laugh.
"Alastair Sinclair, need I remind you that you may have hidden your tracks well by going through shell company after shell company. But when you get down to it, the Salamanca is Scorpion's property, whatever the trade guild, the merchant guild, or the tax collector might think."
A gentle, gurgling laugh sounded from Kate, forcing a wry smile from Alastair. Their moment of joviality over, Kate continued in a more serious tone.
"Your father always suspected that one day you would need a method to get off planet in a hurry, or he would never have spent the credits buying this old heap of junk."
Kate gave another of her infectious giggles.
"Heap of junk, indeed,"
thought Alastair. The Salamanca was Kate's pride and joy. Like many merchant ships plying their trade around the galaxy, the Salamanca was a product of Jiha shipyards. The millipede like Jiha may only be 4 feet long, but with multiple pincers combining to make highly dexterous arms, they were prodigious shipbuilders, and, like most things in the Galactic Union, their ships were built to last. Salamanca was a Luca-class merchant ship, at 540 feet long and grossing 28,000 tons. She was on the limits of ships that could land unassisted by specialist support structures on the surface of planets. Her triple fusion torches could push her hefty bulk along at over 11 Gs, which had come as an unpleasant surprise to pursuing warships on a couple of occasions. 1,100 G-hours of reaction mass and 3,200 hours of total fusion output until her F-11 tanks were depleted also made the Salamanca a perfect medium-sized merchantman, and thousands had been built. Over 200 years old, she had been patched, repaired, and updated so many times over the years that both the outer hull and the ship's layout would have been unrecognizable to the original builders, a fact that had come in handy when the Scorpions procured it 30 years before, and had made a few modifications of their own. More powerful anti-missile laser turrets, anti-missile missiles, reinforced hull armor, more powerful shield generators, and another couple of less conventional twists that would come as a nasty surprise to any potential foe had all been added. The Salamanca may not have been able to take on and defeat a dedicated warship in a stand-up fight, but any frigate or destroyer captain had better be damned wary of her. Over the years, she had, albeit sparingly, inserted and retrieved the Scorpions whenever they needed to fly below the radar. Therefore, several of her standard cargo bays were not so standard. An untrained eye might have missed the adaptations for accommodating troopers and handling Caspers, but lifting 150 troopers and equipment would require much more overt modifications.
"I can make Earth orbit in—"
Kate caught the eye of her Pendal pilot, Horak. With one of his lower limbs, he interrogated the navigation computer, which obligingly displayed the information Kate required in the bottom left corner of her display.
38 hours, and be on the ground shortly after.
We'll be ready. Sinclair clear.
Pushing back in his chair, Alistair turned to once more face the silently scrolling data on his oversized wall display. If those numbers were correct, things were coming to a head, and soon. Really soon.
Chapter 3. Get Out of Dodge. Even to Alistair's trained eye, it looked like complete chaos, with troopers running this way and that, hauling pallets piled high with everything from mac rounds to missile spares to rations, all disappearing at a prodigious rate up the gaping loading ramps of the Salamanca. Amid the apparent confusion stood Kristen LaPole, directing operations like a conductor would an orchestra. At her side was Hack Voslow, his blue near-feather plumage, making the native beach more resemble the Earth avian that it was often compared to. Hack held a small slate in each of his upper hands, checking off the loaded equipment as it rushed past him, while the lower two grasped at the padded jacket it wore to protect it against the growing cool breeze that whipped across the large landing area the Salamanca nestled on. On the turned-up collar of the jacket, the twin silver bars glinted in the pale Scottish sunlight, indicating his status to those who didn't recognize the beach as Salamanca's second-in-command. Not for the first time, Alistair marveled at Kate Priceman's ability to mold such a disparate group of humans and aliens into an efficient crew. And, more importantly, a crew that knew when to keep their mouths shut when the Salamanca was employed on some of its more nefarious jobs. He supposed the money helped. Kate and the Salamanca were able to show a modest profit year in, year out, which kept them under the radar of any busybody government civil servant, while each crew member received an end-of-year off-the-books bonus in the currency of their choice. With such lucrative employment, the crew of the Salamanca tended to remain unchanged for many years, and close relatives often replaced retiring crew members. Take Hack, for example. Hack's father, Yara Voslow, was Kate's first officer. He had carried out his duties for more than 2 decades before bringing his firstborn, Hack, into the family business. Thankfully, Kate had immediately taken to the no-nonsense beach. Besides being an outstanding second-in-command, Hack also attended to the mountain of paperwork, which was the lot of a starship captain, while running a transport business. Kate was eternally grateful. Now, watching Hack and LaPole work in perfect harmony, Alistair could only thank God for his own fortune at having LaPole and his team. Another couple of hours and loading would be complete. And then what? A frown creased Alistair's forehead as he wondered what his next move would be. When he had briefed his officers and senior NCOs 2 days ago in the comfortable surroundings of the main headquarters, he had been certain something big was about to happen. However, when Lieutenant Rivero, Gamma Support Platoon's OC, had asked,
"But Colonel, where is this threat coming from? We're busy preparing to evacuate the base, yet every other Merc company on this planet is carrying on business as usual. What do we know that they don't?"
Rivero hadn't meant the question to be impertinent. Nevertheless, it had riled Alistair. Looking back, Rivero's words had touched a chord for a simple reason. Alistair had had no answer for the young lieutenant. The urgent beeping and vibrating of the small slate in the utility pouch attached to his waist came as a pleasant distraction from his morose thoughts.
"Go for Sinclair," he said, as he answered the call.
The level voice of the senior duty communications tech failed to hide her underlying concern.
"Sir, you need to get over here."
Alistair was moving before he even terminated the call.
his feet pounding the floor as he broke into a sprint. Troopers scattered to the left and right as they scrambled out of his path. Situated in the secure area lay the communications room, buried 25 feet below the headquarters building and around a mile from the landing pad where Alistair had been observing the loading of the Salamanca. The hybrid vehicle he had ridden from the landing pad used a circuitous hardened track, so Alistair had chosen to ignore the indirect route and had run directly across the undulating sand dunes, shielding the Scorpion's buildings from the backblast of ships. Alistair may have been approaching 50, but he had been subjected to a physical training regimen from his early teens. First by his father, then by a particularly evil retired drill instructor by the name of Juru Fuji. Fuji had made it his mission in life to push the young Alistair to the brink of death, or so it seemed. Alistair had endured hours of endless physical training, weapons training, tactical studies, Casper maintenance, and mock scenarios. So many hours of schooling that by the time Alistair joined the Scorpions as a fresh-faced first lieutenant, he felt like he had been a member of the mercenary company for a lifetime. However, Alistair had quickly discovered that whatever Fuji had put him through, his training had provided only a small taste of the reality of being a mercenary for hire. Nothing could prepare you for your first shock of battle, or for the loss of the first trooper under your command. The discipline his father and Fuji had drilled into him had served him well, and, in hindsight, those hours of blood, sweat, and tears were well worth it. So much so, he had found a Fuji of his own when it came time for his own children to begin learning the ropes. It had been tough watching first Charlie, then Jamie, come home day after day, battered and bruised, only to then plug themselves into the Ethernet to study whatever subject their tutor had set for them that evening. By the time it came to Nikki, his youngest child and only daughter, he had relented and discontinued the harsh training regime for the little girl that was the apple of his eye. Every time Alistair looked at her, he saw Elena, his wife, partner, and second in command. Taken from him too soon, by some unknown Tortantula and its Flattar rider, while conducting a contract on some crappy planet in the middle of nowhere that nobody had cared about. Elena's loss had ripped a hole in Alistair's world that he had never quite filled. And seeing Nikki, who could very well have been a clone of his dead Elena, growing up, he just could not bring himself to put her in a position where he might lose her, too. That had probably been the biggest mistake of his life. For Nikki had grown up watching what her older brothers had been put through, and rather than having been put off by it, she relished the opportunity to impress her father. And when that opportunity was taken away, the first seeds of resentment had been sown. Was she not good enough? Had she annoyed her father in some way? With the stubbornness that had been such a strong trait of her mother, Nikki had decided to train herself. She surreptitiously sought out the men and women who formed the small Scorpion's training cadre and demanded they help her. When that didn't work, she reverted to bribery and coercion. Not that a 14-year-old girl had much to bribe a trooper who earned the equivalent of a small fortune every year. It never occurred to her that from her very first approach, the troopers had reported it to her father, who, seeing how important it must be to Nikki, had agreed to allow a limited amount of training. Nothing too dangerous, just enough to let her think she was getting the same training as her siblings had. Unfortunately, Nikki turned out to be a natural. And gradually, Alistair had allowed the members of the training cadre to increase the difficulty level. By the time Nikki was a couple of weeks shy of her 17th birthday, the trainers were forced to admit they had nothing more to teach the girl. On the day of Nikki's birthday, Alistair presented her with a burnished blue 1911 A145 ACP, one of a matching pair that Alistair's forefather had carried into action during World War II. Nikki accepted the pistol with trembling hands. The 2.5-pound pistol looked massive in her delicate hands. However, the trembling was not brought on by anticipation of the present. It was by what she had to say to her father. Words that echoed in Alistair's memory.
"I've decided to apply for the peacemakers,"
Nikki stated, all the while holding her father's eye unblinkingly. Not since his wife's passing had Alistair felt the same icy cold ball form in his stomach. And his reaction to his daughter's blunt statement was the same as it had been then. Disbelief, followed by denial.
"If you think that is for the best."
Those 8 simple words had driven a gulf between father and daughter so wide that they had not spoken in 5 years. Tim Buchanan's chance meeting with her on Karma was the first solid lead he had had on her whereabouts for nearly 2 years. And by the sound of it, Nikki was still the hellraiser she had always been. Alistair gave a wry grin despite himself, as his feet carried him over the final sand dune on his race toward the solid, reinforced door on the west side of the headquarters building. Barely pausing to allow the computer to scan his retinal code and confirm Alistair was who he claimed, he pushed open the door and took the downward spiraling steps 3 at a time. Entering the subdued main communications room, Alistair was confronted by the stoic faces of Tim and Jamie. As was his place as senior officer, Jamie quickly brought Alistair up to speed.
9 minutes ago, we began receiving reports of multiple unannounced arrivals in the emergence area. When hailed by the near-Earth traffic controller, the ships, now confirmed as 64 mixed warships and heavy transports, ignored them. They quickly oriented themselves and lit their fusion torches.
Jamie gave a curt nod to one of the communications techs, who activated the trivi. A wire-framed globe with the continents drawn on it flickered into existence. Alistair's tactical eye rapidly assessed the various ships' projected trajectories.
"Holy shit. This is nothing short of an invasion,"
Alistair said in hushed tones. Tim and Jamie nodded in silent agreement. The computer caught up with Alistair's assessment, as in the hovering display, thin red lines spread from each ship to intersect at various points in Earth's orbit. It was Tim's turn to let out a half-heard profanity, as he identified the locus of the ship's destinations.
"Uzbekistan and Texas."
Tim's fingers stabbed at the display.
"They're targeting the remaining 4 horsemen troops on Earth."
"And there is no guarantee that they, whoever they are going to stop there. And I'm not willing to bet my troopers' lives on it."
Alistair placed a hand on the shoulder of the communications tech.
"Get me the Salamanca."
Seconds later, the face of Kate Priceman was staring sullenly back at him. Shipboard routine dictated that the traffic control frequencies be continually monitored, so Kate was already aware of the arrival of a large number of unidentified warships, and, if any more proof was needed that Alistair's gut feeling had been right, those millions of tons of armor, cannon, and missiles was it.
"Aunt Kate, we need to lift now," said Alistair.
"Way ahead of you, Alistair. I'm buttoning up as we speak. By the time you get your ass back here, I'll be ready to lift."
If Alistair had had the time, he would have said a small prayer thanking God for his aunt's ability to make quick decisions.
Damn, she would have made a great merc.
Instead, Alistair cut the link and spun to face the expectant faces of Jamie and Tim. Alistair began firing orders faster than rounds from a Mac.
"Jamie, get all our Category 1 people aboard the Salamanca, strapped in and ready to lift ASAP."
Jamie did not bother acknowledging his father's order. He simply turned and ran out the door while activating his pen plants for immediate access to the Scorpion's secure communications link. As he raced up the stairs leading to the surface, he sent a priority message to all the Category 1 personnel, or, as they were normally referred to, the war fighters.
Flash message. Board now and prepare for immediate departure.
Across the base, the members of Gamma and Zulu companies simply stopped whatever they were doing and rushed to comply with Jamie's order. Aboard the Salamanca, crewmen dodged to one side as 150 grim-faced troopers made their way to the hastily adapted cramped cargo holds and strapped themselves in, while platoon sergeants counted them off as they arrived. In the communications room, Alistair was not finished giving orders.
Tim, Category 2. I want support personnel cleared from the landing pad ASAP and en route to their assembly points. No sense in them being anywhere near a big fat target like the Salamanca if our friends decide to come calling. Once you've got them moving, I want you to get yourself aboard.
Alistair spared a glance at the illuminated figures of the digital timepiece on the wall.
You have 10 minutes.
Tim gave his boss a curt nod as he too headed for the door. The sound of his voice issuing the necessary instructions over his comms grew more distant as he made his way up the stairs. Alistair had already switched to his next order of business. Being a mercenary was seen by many to be either a glamorous life full of action and adventure, which resulted in a never-ending supply of rich pay packets, or, as some would have you believe, a solitary life full of nothing but death and destruction, while your yak overflowed with blood money. Whatever your views on the mercenary life, there was something which an outsider tended to forget. The men and women who filled the ranks were human, and humans were, overall, not creatures of solitude. They had families, and the men and women of the Scorpions were no different. Over to the east of the sprawling base were the neat rows of two-story homes that housed the husbands, wives, and children of the married personnel, and ensuring their safety was as much a priority for Alistair as that of his troopers. Activating his own pinplants, Alistair was connected to the one person on the base who the awesome responsibility for keeping the family safe fell to.
"Go for the pole,"
answered an expectant voice. Alistair knew his supply officer had been awaiting his call. She couldn't have failed to notice that her orderly loading of the Salamanca had come to a grinding halt. Many troopers abandoned their assigned tasks to make their way aboard the ship, while others shepherded civilian support staff toward their assembly points, ready to exit the base. LaPole had never been one for small talk, so Alistair got straight to the point.
"I've ordered a full evacuation, Kristen."
"Understood, sir. How many family members are still on base?"
"Yeah, straight to the point,"
thought Alistair, turning his head in the direction of Sergeant Quant, the senior comms tech. Quant had anticipated Alistair, and a command via her pinplants sent the necessary information to LaPole's slate. Alistair heard a grunt over his link as LaPole received and digested the information before speaking.
"Okay, I've got that. 42 currently on base. I'll round up the waifs and strays. I presume the plan is still to head for the lodge."
The aptly named Lodge lay on an isolated and peaceful stretch along the edge of Loch Ness. Normally accessed by air, the large hunting lodge complex hid the trappings of modern life and provided the perfect place for overworked Scorpions, troopers, and their families to relax. The lodge could easily cope with the 42 family members.
"The medium assault flyer we use for practice drops can handle 42. It might be cramped, but it means I can lift them in one sortie rather than shuttling back and forth in one of the smaller flyers," said LaPole.
"Yeah, I think that is for the best until we can figure out the intentions of those ships. Good luck, Kristen, and I'll see you on the flip side."
Terminating the link, Alistair noted the communications techs concentrating on the flow of information, while resisting the temptation to follow Jamie and Tim out the door and take their allocated seats on board the soon-to-be-leaving ship.
"Ewan,"
Alistair addressed the junior tech,
"slay your links to the Salamanca and get going.
A flurry of fingers and commands via his pinplants ensured the Salamanca's communications section received a mirror image of the sophisticated setup of the Scorpion's control room. Disconnecting the two hair-thin cables from behind each of his ears, which joined his pinplants to the base's main computer, Ewan stood ready to leave, but hesitated as his eyes met those of the senior tech. Sergeant Katrien Quant held her subordinate's eyes for a fleeting moment, before giving him a weak smile and jerking her head in the direction of the door. Ewan gave her a thin smile of his own, before obeying Alistair's command. Their exchange had not escaped Alistair, but he had the good grace to wait until the junior tech left before saying, "Katrien."
"No need, sir,"
she said with a shrug and a resigned tone.
"Even if I don't want to admit it, it makes sense. Someone must stay until you get clear, in case there's a problem with a link to the Salamanca, and you need up-to-the-minute data if you're to make good your escape. It's just bad luck that I'm right here, right now."
The terminal in front of her gave a shrill beep. Quant's eyes narrowed as she scanned her trivy.
"Well, that's not good,"
she said in a low voice. Alistair leaned over the back of her swivel chair to see the trivy for himself, and his eyes narrowed. In the display, three huge troopships were descending on an area in central Uzbekistan.
"Looks like the Golden Horde are about to have some unwelcome visitors."
"Should we warn them?" asked Quant.
"I'm pretty sure they know they're coming. But give them a heads up anyway."
Quant sent the necessary commands via her pinplants, composing a message which included a complete projection of the troopship's flight paths and projected landing sites.
"Sir, they replied that they are aware, and they are warning all mercenary companies to leave Earth and join up with a convoy in space."
"Did they say to where?"
"No, just that more info will be provided en route. They were worried about the signal being intercepted."
Alistair stood behind her, watching the icons representing decelerating troopships falling to Earth. It was still hard to believe, but the descending ships and their fleetmates moving into blocking positions in orbit were proof enough. This is what all the hidden messages and contracts had been about. Invasion. Alistair accessed the communications terminal, bringing up a previously stored message. One he had composed weeks previously before his eldest son, Charlie, had left for Galax. The text of the message was innocuous, and Alistair and Charlie hoped anyone intercepting it would take it as a pleasantry between father and son. It read, "Happy birthday, son. Love, Dad." But it was a signal to Charlie. The message translated as, "The Scorpions have abandoned their base. Prepare for the worst." Alistair could do nothing for his firstborn or his troopers, and his inadequacies weighed heavy on his shoulders. But what more could he do? Right now, he had his own problems and responsibilities. A command sent the message flashing through the ether to join the stack of outgoing traffic held in the local Galnet node, awaiting download to the next ship to use the Stargate, headed in the direction of the Koro region in the Tolo arm of the galaxy. Then, the message would hitch a ride to the furthest Galnet node, which, finally, routed the text to the first ship headed to Galax. It could be weeks before the message arrived, but Alistair hoped Charlie would receive the warning in time.
"Sir,"
said Quant, interrupting Alistair's thoughts,
"traffic control is filling with reports of sporadic ship-to-ship engagements. Looks like someone is up for a fight."
Alistair leaned in close to the trivy, as if by staring at the icons on the display he could divine the warring factions. What he saw, though, was a carbon copy of the traffic control readout. The trivy filled with ghost images and flashes of static as the dueling warships permeated the electronic spectrum with powerful countermeasures against targeting systems, burning through their foes' countermeasures with their own weapons. Who was winning or losing was impossible to tell, but the battle did provide an opportunity for the Salamanca to make good its escape, while both sides were busy taking swings at each other.
"The minute we're clear and out of range, wipe everything. Then hightail it to join Captain Lapole. Understood?"
"Understood, sir, and good luck. I wish I was going with you."
Alistair gave Quant's shoulder a reassuring squeeze before it was finally time for him to depart, leaving the sergeant alone in her darkened underground bunker. Quant blocked out the sound of his receding footsteps and commanded her eyes to remain fixed on her display as she tried to make some sense of what was happening hundreds of miles above her head. Chapter 4 No Time to Mourn.
"Whenever you are ready, Mr. Horak," Kate said,
more of a command than an invitation, one which the Pendle pilot reacted to with calm, precise movements as his lower limbs engaged the Salamanca's lift motors, while his upper limbs were still running through the checklist to ensure the final personnel lock was secured and the ramp retracted behind the final person to board, Alistair Sinclair. The same Alistair Sinclair, as if on cue, slipped into the only spare seat on the cramped bridge. His seat, sensing the ship's acceleration, automatically deployed its restraints to secure Alistair in place. A good thing for Alistair, as Horak steadily increased thrust, raising the nose of the ship as the engine strained to push the 50,000-ton, fully loaded merchantman skyward. Alistair and the rest of the bridge crew were pushed further back into their padded seats as the G-forces steadily increased. The seat deployed its G-shroud, wrapping Alistair's arms, legs, and chest in its protective layers, contracting around his limbs and forcing blood to his brain to enable him to continue functioning. He spared a thought for his troopers, squeezed together like sardines in a can in their makeshift seats in the ship's cargo holds, completely unprotected from the overpowering G-forces. The repeater display, which had deployed from the armrest of his seat, indicated Horak was pushing the ship toward the upper limit of the human body's ability to withstand the G-forces pushing down on it. Alistair felt his muscles straining as the G-number passed 6 Gs. The G-shroud would allow him to continue operating until about 9 Gs, depending on his personal tolerance, but he knew that his unprotected troopers would, at the current 6 Gs, be suffering from grayout, where their vision lost hue, while some may already have passed out. After 3 minutes, Horak throttled the engines back as the Salamanca passed through the waning atmosphere and began to enter space proper. Alistair felt the crushing weight lift from his chest as he watched in strange fascination as a small slate that had not been secured before liftoff floated lazily past. Reaching out with one hand, he plucked it from the air and slipped it into the storage pocket on the leg of his utility suit. Better to be safe than sorry. If Horak was forced to make any radical high-G maneuvers, that slate could very quickly turn into a ballistic weapon, either causing damage to equipment on the bridge, or, worse still, striking some poor member of the bridge crew. And that included Alistair.
"Let's keep all our active radio, radar, and LIDAR transmissions locked down good and tight, everybody. No need to give any of those warships a nice new shiny target," said Kate from her seat at the center of the small bridge. "Mr. Jacobstall."
The dual-hatted communications and defensive systems officer, originally from South Africa, cocked his head so his sun-tanned face and searing blue eyes faced his captain.
"Bring up the feed from Sergeant Quant and put it on the main thrivey."
An area of the bridge wall measuring 20 feet square resolved itself into a shifting, fuzzy, and confusing picture of the space surrounding the Salamanca out to 1,500 miles. As expected of an industrialized planet, every type of craft filled the near space of Earth. Merchantmen, private cruisers, tugs, intrasystem small craft, and many others of every shape and size. All had one thing in common. Each ship pushed their engines to the max to get clear of the deadly missiles and flashing, coherent light weapons of the battling warships. Alistair was the first to admit he was no expert on ship-to-ship warfare, and certainly not on this scale. As the icon of a human destroyer flickered and died, a palpable silence descended on the bridge. The situation was dire. Even to Alistair, it was obvious that whomever the invaders were, they were rapidly gaining the upper hand. Kate leaned forward in her seat, her eyes flickering in all directions as she sought to pick a safe route for the Salamanca and its precious cargo.
"Aha! Mr. Horak, 186 Mark 2-3 should pass us well clear of that Hexar guided missile cruiser. Even if she picks us up, she'll think we're just another Merchie trying to get clear of the fighting and get away through the Stargate."
The Yal's shortened, prehensile tail flicked involuntarily from side to side in short, sharp motions, and a pair of large, ovoid nostrils at the end of a long, flattened, lime-green snout flared. Sure signs to Gyal's crew that the commander of the Hexar guided missile cruiser, Great Claw, was enjoying himself. In this assumption they would have been correct, for Gyal and his crew's participation in this contract was no coincidence. Their employer had sought them out, but they had known that money only buys so much loyalty. The need for revenge, however, goes much further. And that need burned deep within the Hexar aboard Great Claw and its sister ships. When the human-led ships of the Winged Hussars burned his nestmates from the skies in the F-11-rich Ligel system and the Praf sector, they had made a blood enemy of Gyal. His ship, Great Claw, circled the human sparkling blue and white globe, and Gyal struggled to keep his burgeoning excitement in check as he watched the few human ships who had decided to fight be washed away in the eye-searing light of megawatt lasers and waves of missiles. Gyal could hardly contain himself as he struggled with the conflict between the need to follow his orders, to remain in his blocking position over the landmass the humans called Western Europe, while sweeping its skies with his armed drone craft, and the desire to join the battle raging over the Americas.
"Commander," called the Hexar manning the tactical sensors, "a ship approaches at high G. A Luca-class merchantman."
"Point of origin?" demanded Gyal.
The crew member interrogated his computers, swiftly backtracking the ship's flight path.
"The northern part of an island off the main landmass."
A corner of his thin, rubbery lip rose to expose razor-sharp yellowed teeth.
"The area is listed as one of those belonging to a human mercenary company."
A thick, clawed finger ran down the electronic compendium supplied by their employer for this contract until it came to rest on a name.
"Sinclair's Scorpions."
A merchant ship running from a known human mercenary base made it a viable target by the rules of engagement set down in the contract, and it would bring a large bounty when the ship and its cargo was sold to the highest bidder. Gyal flexed his triple-clawed hands, his claws raking the reinforced armrests as his elongated spine tingled with anticipation. The claws dug fresh scratches to join the numerous ones already there.
"Helmsman! Plot an intercept course. Weapons. Bring the spinal laser online and load the forward missile tubes. Tactical. Retask one of the drones to fly past the ship's point of origin. If there are any more ships, I want to know."
One of the few inviolable rules of warfare in the Galactic Union was that no spaceship could fire on a planet's surface from an altitude of more than 10 miles. By using semi-autonomous armed drones, which flew below this height, the Hexar and others could get around this rule. As long as they still did not order devastating mass strikes, the Union was willing to turn a blind eye to this bending of the rule. In Gayal's case, the drones under his command were intended for reconnaissance purposes only, though they did, of course, carry several missiles for their own protection. Orders given, Gayal felt the familiar pressure of increasing G-force as the Great Claw came about onto the intercept course plotted by its helmsman, and increased speed. Through his seat, he felt the thrum of the fusion plants coming to full power and filling the capacitors with the energy required by the cruiser's main 100-terawatt lasers, while weapons crews did final checks on sleek, telegraph pole-sized anti-ship missiles before loading them into their launch tubes. In less than 2 minutes, Great Claw was ready for combat. Gayal's pink tongue flicked out to wet his lips as the thrill of the hunt filled him like it had his ancestors on the great plains of his homeworld.
"Time to intercept."
12 minutes, Commander. "Permission to paint the target," replied the tactical officer.
Gayal paused momentarily as he considered the request. If he allowed the tactical officer to activate the targeting and acquisition radar, his prey would almost certainly pick up the waves of electromagnetic energy directed at it, and may take evasive action. On the other hand, his missiles and lasers would need the targeting data if they were to successfully intercept the fleeing merchantman. And, as Gayal reminded himself, it was only a merchantman after all. What chance did it have against a warship?
"Granted," said Gayal.
"Shit, shit, shit. That's not good,"
Kate Priceman exclaimed to no one, as the Trivee dispassionately noted the course change of the Hexham missile cruiser. From his seat against the rear bulkhead, Alastair Sinclair strained against his restraints as he tried to see what caused his aunt's outburst. Without the benefit of access to the repeater screens, which sprouted like multiple arms from Kate's seat, he was reliant on others telling him what was going on, a situation Alastair found most uncomfortable.
"What's happening?" he demanded.
With a tap of the foot release, Kate spun her seat to face him, worry lines plain on her face.
"Looks like that cruiser wants a piece of us. What the hell is going on here, Alastair?"
Alastair shook his head slowly.
"I truly wish I knew."
Kate's eyes hovered on her nephew for a few more seconds, realizing eventually that she was not going to get a better answer to her question, before spinning her seat around again and locking it in place. With a tap of a control, she activated the intership comm, and a three-tone whistle sounded throughout the Salamanca, followed a heartbeat later by Kate's stoic voice.
"All hands, prepare for radical maneuvering."
Cutting the comm, Kate addressed her bridge crew.
"Okay, people. This isn't going to be pretty, but those Hexar bastards have no idea what they have bitten off for the Salamanca."
Focusing on one crew member, she gave the command that committed the Salamanca to the fight.
"Mr. Jacobsall, if you please."
A predatory grin spread over Jacobsall's face, as perfect white teeth, appearing prominently in his darkly tanned features, were bared. With a command through his pinplants, a dozen protective housings along the upper and lower spine of the speeding merchantman slipped obediently aside to reveal stubby-nosed, rapid-fire railguns. The guns may be as useful as spit against the oncoming cruiser's multi-phase shield array, but when used as a close-in weapon system, the clouds of the baseball-sized tungsten balls they threw into the paths of oncoming missiles, drones, or small crafts were deadly.
"Keep the array and electronic countermeasures offline for the moment, Mr. Jacobsall," said Kate,
anticipating and staying the man's next move.
"They think we are just a plain, old, slow and dumb merchie, ripe for the picking. Let's keep them suffering from that delusion for as long as we can. Knowing the Hexar, they'll try and seize us as a prize, and to do that, they'll have to get within knife-fighting range. probably send over a boarding party. So let's keep the really good news under wraps till then, shall we?
A short burst of laughter echoed around the bridge, and a confused Alastair stared open-mouthed from face to face.
Were these people nuts? There was no way a merchie like the Salamanca could take on a Hexha-guided missile cruiser. But it looked like Kate was about to.
Well, if she was going to fight, then he was damned if he would sit idly by and do nothing. Kate had mentioned a boarding party, and Alastair knew exactly how to give a boarding party a warm reception.
"Permission to leave the bridge, Captain?"
Alastair asked as he fumbled with the unfamiliar seat restraints. Kate's face spun to face him.
"And where the hell do you think you are going, Alastair?"
she demanded. The last restraint came free, and Alastair stood, shrugging off his utilities to reveal the thin haptic suit beneath. He was now held in place only by two footholds, as the lack of gravity vainly attempted to float him across the bridge.
"You mentioned a boarding party. Would it not be polite of us to greet them properly?"
A wicked grin tugged at Kate's lips as a throaty chortle escaped her.
"You, Alastair Sinclair, are a bad man."
She glanced at one of her repeater screens.
"You have 9 minutes until we begin maneuvers, and God help anybody who isn't strapped in."
"Understood."
Alastair slipped out of the footholds and pushed deftly for the armored bridge doors, which opened with a hiss of hydraulics at a command from Kate. Pulling himself hand over hand toward the cargo bays where his troops and their Caspers were situated, he activated his link to Jamie and Tim.
"First Platoon Zulu and 3rd Platoon Gamma, prepare to repel boarders. You have 7 minutes to get suited up and ready to move."
The silence of the communications bunker was broken by the steady hum of the electronics, which were the only things keeping Katrien Quant company. The tech sergeant's full attention was locked on the feed she was getting from traffic control. Dozens of ships, highlighted in red, were now either in Earth's orbit or descending into the atmosphere.
"Fuck!"
A command enlarged the area around the projected flight path of the Salamanca, as one of the red icons, the computer identified it as a Hexha cruiser, broke from its orbit and powered toward the ship carrying her friends and colleagues. Almost without conscious thought, Quant sent a query to the central comms computer to ensure the feed was still being relayed to the fleeing ship in real time. As the computer confirmed her link was still strong, a voice intruded on the silence of the bunker.
"Comms, this is LePole. I have 42 souls aboard, and I'm ready to lift. You better get your ass over here if you want a ride."
Quant threw another glance at the screen, upon which the computer had helpfully traced the intercept course of the Hexha cruiser. It took Quant only a moment to come to her decision.
"Negative, ma'am. It looks like the Salamanca might be in trouble. So I think I'll stay right here in case they need me."
For a long second, silence lingered over the comms link, before a softer voice, which Quant barely recognized as belonging to the tough-as-nails supply officer, replied,
"Understood, Sergeant. Good luck, Trooper. And I'll see you at the lodge. LePole out."
Kristen LePole gently eased the throttles forward, and the assault flitter rose from the pad in response. In the co-pilot seat beside her, Mary Sinclair set her jaw and busied herself with the controls arrayed before her. Kristen spared a sideways glance at Mary, who had overheard the exchange between Kristen and Quant, so there was no hiding the fact that her father-in-law, Alastair, her brother-in-law, Jamie, and the other troopers aboard the Salamanca were in danger. However, like the professional pilot Mary had been before marrying the eldest Sinclair son, Charlie, and retiring from mercenary life, she was entirely focused on the job at hand, ensuring her two children, strapped into the rear of the flitter, and the 39 other family members and dependents of the Scorpions, reached the safety of the lodge.
"Power coming up nicely, Kristen. 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet, 50 feet. Ready to transition into forward flight."
In the left-hand seat, Kristen deftly twisted the stick, bringing the twin turbofans from vertical to horizontal, allowing the nose to dip as the flitter picked up speed.
"Estimated flight time, 26 minutes,
called out Mary. Out of muscle memory more than conscious thought, Mary brought the assault flitter's threat detection systems online, only for the system to immediately scream. Mary's eyes widened.
"Hexha search radar! 5 miles and closing!"
Kristen responded instinctively, dropping the nose of the flitter even further and adding power, hoping to confuse the radar searching for them by hiding in the back clutter from the towering pine trees.
"Commander, the drones are reporting a second launch originating from the same area as the merchantman. A human assault flitter."
Eyal had been concentrating on the chase, calculating the minor adjustments needed to place his cruiser on course with the merchantman's in order to bring his main laser batteries to bear before launching his armed boarding party and seizing the vessel. The interruption of his tactical officer was unexpected, and he reacted without considering his actions fully.
"Probably a group of mercenaries trying to escape before we round up the cowards. Order the drones to engage and destroy."
The tactical officer acknowledged his orders and input the necessary commands, his attention returning to the bigger prize of the merchantman as he imagined the riches it carried and how he would spend his share. At an altitude of 30,000 feet, the central processor deep in the heart of the plastic and gel brain of the drone received the command.
"Processing. Confirming location. Location confirmed. Mode, track and survey, off. Mode, attack, on."
Much faster than any human reaction, the drone switched modes and targeted the armored flitter. The radar on the nose increased its pulse until a near constant stream hammered the skin of the flitter with electromagnetic energy. The fire control computer took account of the backscatter caused by ground clutter, but dismissed it. A thin seam along the bottom of the drone's radar-absorbent material split and widened, exposing the weapons hold and a rotary drum from which 6 evil-looking missiles hung. The drum rotated as the computer selected an air-to-air missile. A final health check confirmed the missile was good to go. Locking clamps retracted, and the missile fell from the drum. The hold doors closed again, returning the drone to near-radar invisibility. Clear of the drone, winglets popped out from the missile's main body. The chemical rocket engine ignited, and the missile accelerated to Mach 3. The data link from the drone allowed the missile to keep its radar in standby mode until the final attack on the target, concealing its presence until the last possible moment. The radar, mounted in the tail of the armored flitter, caught the handful of seconds the drone's weapons bay doors were open, and obediently reported them to Mary Sinclair.
"Possible missile launch! Evade, evade!"
Outwardly, Mary's voice remained cold and professional as she reported to LaPole. But inwardly, she struggled to keep her thoughts from her two children, strapped in on the other side of the cockpit doors. LaPole flung the flitter into a tight 4G turn, hauling on the stick to force the heavy flitter around, dropping the nose and adding power, desperately trying to hide the infrared signature of the flitter's turbofans, while masking the flitter's bulk behind the steadily rising terrain as the flitter headed inland.
"They've still got us locked up," called Mary,
as the radar warning buzzer continued its steady warbling. The green, tree-covered landscape was flying past the cockpit windows, the low sun casting long shadows across what would have been beautiful vistas. But Mary and Lepole were too busy trying to save their precious cargo's lives to admire the view. The terrain following radar threw the fleeing flitter a desperately needed lifeline.
High terrain, 2 o'clock, 3 miles.
Lepole's eyes flicked in the direction Mary had indicated for a split second as she fractionally corrected her course. A bead of perspiration dropped into her right eye, blurring her vision, and she blinked madly to clear it. The flitter was flashing across the ground at 450 miles per hour, and a single mistake would see the flitter and its human contents plow into the ground, leaving nothing but a long gouge of light brown earth and a few charred remains. High above, the inscrutable brain of the drone noted the flitter's evasive maneuvers, and its cold calculations resulted in a lowering of the odds of a successful prosecution of the target. This was not acceptable. Once more, the weapons bay doors opened and released an arrow-shaped missile, which shot away. However, this time the missile, rather than following the flight path of its compatriot, maintained its altitude. Spearing forward at speeds nearing Mach 5, it was less than 45 seconds from its destination. The warbling of the radar alarm changed in an instant to a high-pitched screeching as the seeker head on the missile went active. Mary may have been retired from active duty, however, as her husband, Charlie, took great relish in pointing out, once a merc, always a merc. He laughed at his wife as she read tech manuals and kept abreast in the latest weapons developments. It was a pastime she found strangely cathartic after chasing two kids around all day. Those moments of relaxation came in use now, as the onboard computer identified the hunting missile's radar type.
Hexha series XC-270, usually fitted to their Tall 9 missiles, Mary recited from memory. Missile has an infrared and radar seeker. Proximity warhead. Radar goes active only on final target acquisition. Susceptible to
radical course changes of its target at the last minute, finished Lepole for her.
Mary turned her face to Lepole in time to see the Merc captain flash her an evil smile.
Flares and chaff on my command.
Lepole flexed the fingers of her right hand on the control stick, as her left dropped to her side and found the turbofan maneuvering controls by touch.
And let's pray to God that the techs kept this bird in good nick. I haven't tried this trick since I was in flight school, and my instructors grounded me for a month afterward.
Mary let out a half-mumbled,
"Oh, shit,"
as she slipped a hand around the fixed handle above her instrument panel and began a range countdown.
Missile at 1 mile. 1,000 yards. Break, break, break! Countermeasures now! Now, now!
Cried Lepole. As she flung the flitter into a radical 5G turn, the towering walls of the glen rose high above as Lepole fought to level the protesting flitter. If Mary had not braced herself against the handle, she would have been flung back in her seat by the turn. As it was, she barely managed to hang on, sending the required command via her pinplants to the flitter's defensive measures pod. On the rear of the craft, a series of soda can-sized objects ejected, and their integral detonators ignited the tightly packed phosphorus, which burned with the intensity of multiple suns and completely blinded the missile's infrared system. Mixed in with the flares were an equal number of containers which, when they burst open, formed a cloud of highly radar-reflective metallic strips, offering the missile's radar-seeker head a big, juicy target. In case that wasn't enough to fling the missile off, Lepole carried out the second part of her plan, and her left hand twisted hard on the turbofan vector controls. The effect was like slamming the brakes on a ground car going at over 300 miles per hour. Every ounce of energy propelling the flitter forward, now blasted in the opposite direction. in a maneuver perfected by the pilots of V-Stall fighters in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. LePaul waited for their airspeed to bleed to